I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We've talked about mental illness and suicide on this program in the past, and today we'll do the same from the unique perspective of a mother who lost her son to a depression-related suicide in 2009. Lynn Keene's son, Daniel, was 23 years old, and in her new book, Give Sorrow Words, she recounts his childhood and the moments before and after his untimely death. The book really is a call to end the stigma around mental illness and provides a marvelous point from which we can talk about and perhaps prevent mental illness. Too many young Canadians are dying from suicide, and I'll ask Ms. Keene about her son, what the process of grieving has been like, and what she's learned about depression, chronic health conditions, and brain injuries in the years since Daniel's death. Lynn Keene is an author and journalist. I first saw her some months ago on our friend Steve Paikin's broadcast, where she talked about suicide prevention, as she does frequently there and in other outlets, both print and broadcast. Her website is at lynnkeene.ca. This book is published by Starburst Digital. It's a tremendous book. I breezed through it rather quickly, not because it's an easy read or a short one, but because it's a compelling read. It's wonderfully heartfelt, punctuated by Daniel's likability, as well it gives voice to the grief that death brings a mother, a family, and a community. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Oakville, Ontario, Lynn Keene. Ms. Keene, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure having you on, especially after having read the book. It's a very powerful read. So when one reads a book like yours, it's difficult to figure out where to start. But I guess Daniel is the heart of the book, and so let's start there. And if you could, tell us what he was like. He just seems, as I said in the introduction, a very likable guy.
Absolutely. Thanks, Joe. I think that is part of the reason why it was such a tremendous shock for our family, but for the sort of the broader community that knew Daniel. I've said before, Daniel was a fixer. And I'll relate that into our family dynamic. If I couldn't figure something out on the computer, well, he'd sort of push me out of the way and he'd fix it. Or if we were having, an argument within the family, he would sort of be the one that would breeze in and say, come on, like, really, is it worth this? And the one thing I always thought about Daniel while he was alive, actually, was he lived in the moment. He lived in the absolute present. And I think that was also attributed to the fact that he grew up with allergies, life-threatening food allergies, as do a lot of kids, and also asthma. And while he managed those, through his life, I think his view of the world was probably slightly different than the rest of his family. He had to be concerned about, what he ate, where he ate, who prepared it. And I think, he actually looked at life very differently, and he enjoyed the good times. He enjoyed the moments that he could. He was also, he was quick to anger at times. I would say before he actually was suffering from, depressive states, he had a temper, but he had this ability to care, and I think that's always what came through to his friends and to the four of us in the family.
And his two sisters, they idolized him, right?
Yeah, so Amy is, she's 25 now, and she was just right around 19 when we lost Daniel. And Emily, his youngest sister, who is much like Daniel in the way they express their humor and the way sometimes they look at the world, she was 15. So, really a child, and when she turned 18, it was as if the suicide was all over again. She was starting to, experience that the loss is more of an adult as a younger person. So, when everybody obviously deals with tragedy, specifically suicide, in different ways, and when I look at the four of us, we all had different relationships with Daniel. And just who, our personalities, we all grieve and are grieving in very different ways. I will say I'm very proud of my family because when I started writing, I kept a lot of the writing to myself, mostly because it was really just sort of still in my head. And I was always afraid of re-traumatizing my family if, the more I spoke publicly. But they allowed me to take them back to the most difficult days of our life and have supported that journey. And, that takes a lot of courage, I think. So I'm very proud of them.
Yeah, and the relationship that Daniel had with his dad, Bruce, I mean, that was close, as was the relationship with you, a mother and son. I mean, you guys were pretty close, right?
And I go back, I mentioned in the book a few times, Daniel, you know, had his challenges with some chronic life conditions. And, you know, young parents, you first of all, you have no understanding of, you know, asthma or allergies, at least we didn't at the time. But I think through those periods of time when his health was compromised, Daniel and I spent a tremendous amount of time together, you know, seeing doctors, whether in the hospital or managing his conditions. And I think that gave us a bond. But he was just one of those guys. He got older and started to take care of me. You know, as I mentioned in the book a few times, I run marathons, and I was training for one when I found out that I had my own chronic health conditions. And he would be, you know, driving the truck behind me saying, "Come on, Mom, get in the car. You know, you're not supposed to be doing this." And so I think he was, like, quite sensitive to not only his, sort of very personal relationships, but to the world generally.
Yeah.
Impacted him, I think, in a way that, you know, really it's the benefit of perspective that I can see that now. You know, I don't think when you're in the midst of living life, I don't think you necessarily look, as I mentioned, in the dark corners or in the things that aren't right in your face. And I certainly didn't, had no understanding, and none of us really, that Daniel was suffering from a catastrophic depression that would eventually lead to his death.
And I mean, the life that he grew up in, I mean, it wasn't a bad life. I mean, it was a pretty good life. I mean, you all loved each other.
Mm-hmm.
In reading the book, what it tells me is that mental illness, depression, I mean, that touches everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead, sorry.
I think, going back to that, Joe, is, you know, the night, you know, we're losing contact with him, and, the next day when we recognized that, you know, there was, obviously, something was wrong. I for a long time, wasn't aware that it was actually that Daniel had died, and in fact, that he had died by suicide. But I, the whole, I'm trying to think back to what you were saying, is that it's such an incredible, life-altering, physical and emotional shock to one day see, you know, a loved family member, you know, just see them, and then to start to understand in the days that, you know, that they have passed, that they took their life. And I think it's such a shock, and that leads to really why I ended up being so vocal, because it was within probably 36 hours of sort of understanding the full, you know, understanding. We were coming to the full understanding of what had occurred and, you know, the hours leading up. I couldn't grasp that the son that was in front of me, the son that I loved, we all loved, was in such pain. And I think the understanding as a mom that I couldn't support a child of mine who was in such desperate pain. I had supported them in other things in all of their lives, and even saying that I still couldn't support him. But I couldn't support him because I had no knowledge of what depression, what mental illness, and then that thread, that hopelessness, and then the feeling that you're a burden, to eventually you have, you know, one has in that state, that is the only, that is the last option. It is not the only option if there's intervention, but in Daniel's case, there was no one with him. So, it's a long-winded way of saying the shock was so immense that I knew in order, I had to speak out. Because I had an experience that could, you know, impact potentially another person's life.
Looking back, because you obviously have done that in the course of writing this book, we've already established that you were quite close as a mother and a son, but there was a point where you sort of drifted apart, and I'm sure in the course of writing the book you figure out where that is. Was that when he left for school? Was that when he started drinking, do you think?
Exactly, yeah. That prior to that, Joe, we, you know, as you said before, we lived a pretty, I'd say, we're pretty fortunate because we the kids wanted to be with both Bruce and I, and we wanted to hang out together. We actually had lots of fun together. So when Daniel went away the first year, to be honest, he probably wasn't, you know, I would say, mature enough in the sense of just. I mean, he was a young man. He seemed very poised and knew what he wanted. But that was what we thought. That was what we sort of intuited on him. It wasn't the case. You know, and I struggle with, you know, kids having to go leave at grade 12 and then be pushed off into, they're supposed to really know what they're doing and then manage themselves. So he was probably one of those kids that probably would have benefited from hanging back a year or doing something else for a year. But having that freedom, there was really no accountability, and because the reality is, the schools won't tell you if your kids aren't in school. Mm-hmm. You won't really realize that until, you know, potentially they've missed their term or they've been, you know, asked to leave. So, you know, I think he was living in Ottawa, and at that time it was really easy for the kids to go over to Hull and get into the bars. And again, you could never point a line to say, you know, because someone is allowed to drink at over in Hull that would end in their death. But here's the reality is that when someone is starting not to manage their life, so as an example, he started to miss class. Mm-hmm. There's that malaise that sort of started to take over him, which was he felt bad. He felt that he let his family down. So it starts to set the person up for, you know, I'm going to now self-medicate. And again, only through the benefit of hindsight can we look at it clearly and say, that was really the turning point. It was around 2006, the summer, when he came back and it was revealed that he had been asked to leave his program. We started to understand, okay, there is a problem here. So there was 3 years before his actual death. So we worked as a family to, you know, you can't drink. You have to, you know, modify your behavior. And he did. You know, that was, you know, we had some struggles, and you know, I own that. I accept that we didn't know how to necessarily manage. And in fact, I'd say to Daniel, you know, Daniel, you shouldn't be going out to bars. You shouldn't be staying up late and then trying to, you know, go to school, do your job in the summertime. And it took probably a whole summer before I could get to him and get him to understand that. But what I said to him that summer that was so difficult was, you know, you've got to get help. But again, not having the tools to understand what was actually at work, what was going on, his brain had changed. Mm-hmm. You know, from there was a period of time, and for what reasons I try to allude to in the book. Again, I'll never know everything, but I do try to put pieces of the puzzle together to give us some understanding that there was a change in his brain chemistry, and then that's when the drinking began, the not being able to concentrate, missing school. So these were all pretty significant things that were happening. But again, as a family, I had no idea that this behavior was symptomatic of someone who was suffering to the degree that Daniel was.
So what are the signs that one should look for in their family, in their friends, if they're wondering how they are?
Yeah. Well, again, I can speak from our experience. Yeah. I think the first thing, Joe, that I'll look back on and say is a pulling away from us. So there would be times when he would say he was coming home for the weekend, and then we would, you know, by the last hour when he was supposed to be there, he'd send us a text or just a quick call saying, I can't make it. I'm doing X. I have to, you know, I got to get caught up on work. So that, and at that time when that was happening, he was not in school. Mm. So it's really, I think before I would say there's specific factors, I'd say just generally as parents, community members, is we need to have a better understanding of basically mental illness. We have to understand not necessarily reasons why it occurs, but just a very cursory understanding. And then from there, I think then we can look at our friends and family members and say, you know, I'm not hearing from you as much, or you don't feel like, you know, doing the things that you wanted to do. You're losing some weight. Your behavior has changed. I feel like you're not telling me the truth. There's, you know, these are the things that we witnessed, but again, in hindsight, they were all sort of separate challenges. Nothing was suggesting that our son was dealing with a catastrophic depression, or that he was manic, bipolar, because Daniel never had the benefit of even having a diagnosis. So, it was a lot of me sort of just trying to look at the behavior, look at the things that we had witnessed, and then go back and talk to researchers and sort of go into the information and put it together. I also bring up, catastrophic brain trauma and concussions. Again, I don't have proof, but I do know what I witnessed, and I know Daniel did hit his head on different occasions in different sports. And that would be something that I think, just as a parent, again, I would have more awareness about concussion and how the brain changes in that, when you have an event like that.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that now with when we hear of sport and the sort, football and even in high school, high school hockey, football and the sort, there's greater awareness of that, right? Not enough, certainly.
But there's definitely, I think, whether it's through a life experience, mm-hmm. childhood adversity, we know now that early childhood adversity will set a person up to potentially view the world differently. Again, you can't say that would, make the person as an adult necessarily have depression, but chronic conditions like asthma, you have a higher risk of having depression-related symptoms as an adult. And so that's the key, is I think when we have more knowledge, then we're able to step in and intervene. And also, I guess, here's the other thing is, when I think of our house and I think of the things that went on around this period of time, 2006, early 2007, we weren't able as parents to be compassionate around what was going on. Again, because we saw this behavior as symptomatic of growing up and we didn't like it, but we were reacting, thinking that this was, out of the order behavior that Daniel was just exhibiting. We didn't like it, but again, we weren't able to bring the love that we had all our lives, with our kids in the most important time that he needed it. And that to me is the tragedy.
Yeah. So how do you deal with what ifs? I mean, I'm sure one could easily get consumed by that the rest of their mm-hmm. day, you know what I mean? I don't know, have you gone through that and have you gotten out of that perhaps?
Well, when you're in shock for months, we were almost catatonic in the house. The phrases that we kept saying was why? Like we would literally say why and then just cry. And it's a process. The reality is when you lose a family member, and particularly in this instance when there's no, you never have the opportunity to, in our case, even try to truly help Daniel, we are left with so many whys. And back in 2009 in September, I remember writing a short essay, and the Globe ended up publishing it. It was really around that I had to stop asking why, because no amount of knowledge in terms of why Daniel ended up taking his life was going to change our circumstances. So in order for me to find my way back to any kind of a life and to parent our two surviving kids, I had to stop asking why and kind of go back to the story of our life. And that's really, probably in 2010 is when I started really writing the book, was saying, stop asking why, and I needed to go and find out. I needed to get close to the pain that Daniel felt. And I didn't have the disease, but in the grief state, I probably was as close to, having depression as I could have ever been, I think.
And understanding it.
Right, understanding the hopelessness of, not wanting to get out of bed, not wanting to really be here. And for the first time in my life, I actually had the sense that I understood what it's like to not want to live here, be part of this world. And so, and the thing is, it's a very fine line, because you can't stay in that place. It's not a healthy place to be. But I knew for a period of time, you know, after the funeral and after we shut the door and closed the blinds and we were basically just stuck without Daniel, I had to live in that pain. And really, for me, it was the beginning of grieving.
I'm assuming that this book wasn't easy to write, but it seems in reading it that there was a great purpose to it. Was there comfort that at the end of writing this that you gained from the process of writing it?
Yeah, and I still find it hard to articulate what it is, but I will say this very briefly. It's the recognition, give Sorrow Words to me now that it's done, is a recognition of our family's journey and of Daniel's life.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of, you know, at first, Joe, I think really, you know, I'll say almost selfishly, Bruce went back to work. He had to go back to work. The girls had to go to school. I am self-employed, so I, you know, was walking around the house, walking in the neighborhood. I really walked in circles a lot. And so being able to sit down with my computer every day, I was able to kind of affect Daniel. I could feel him as I was writing, and so I could kind of get into his. I could see the way he walked on an angle, or I could see, you know, the way he'd look at me in those funny ways he'd look at me, like my mom, you know, mom, really.
Yeah.
And there's peace in that. There was, for me, that was, so I did, you know, and I went back to the time of his death. I went back to how he died. I went back to all of the very brutal images that I conjured them up because I knew I had to face it. If I was going to write honestly, I had to face it. I had to face it in a way, as an example, you know, I make comments of this in the book, is I didn't want to know. I knew very, you know, in the morning on April 29th, I knew pretty quickly Daniel was not coming home. I did not know how. And I begged my husband not to share that with me because I needed to just, I could only take so much at a time. And then once I was ready to really absorb myself, I needed to go into all of it. So in a way, yes, back to your question, I think it allowed me to move forward.
In the book, page 66, you have a beautiful line. Everyone has a first day and a last day. The days in between are gifts. The 28th of April, 2009 was Daniel's last day. Certainly not yours, so it's a day in between.
Yeah.
In a way, has that suicide, has that been a gift for you? I mean, I'll add to what I just said. There's a moving passage in the book where you and Bruce decide to celebrate. I guess one of your daughters decides to celebrate his 25th birthday. And so you go to Toronto to some bar or restaurant, and you're hanging out with Daniel's friends. And you didn't want to do this. I don't think Bruce wanted to do it either. But it ended up being a pretty good experience, right?
Right.
And so you go around with this notebook, and everyone writes their thoughts on Daniel, the remembrances and the sort. His friend Mark writes in the book, he never did anything solely for himself. His intentions were for the common good. At the end of it, did you think his suicide did bring something good to you, your family, his friends even?
You know, it's almost two thoughts. I think if I look, I will say yes in the sense of, I think looking back on anybody's life, particularly a young person who dies suddenly, I think that so much of the sadness is that there's no future, right? And I think that's the hardest part for us, is to see ourselves without the future, without Daniel, and not he doesn't have a future. But what his friends said to us that night and what they wrote spoke to a life that was honest to the degree that he could be while he could be, and it also spoke to the sense of love that he had for close friends and family. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, that's really all we could ever ask for, I think. You know, so knowing that is incredibly comforting. I would trade it in a heartbeat, but I can't. So in lieu of having my son present, I have the knowledge that when he was here, he did good.
Yeah, yeah. In the note, in the suicide note that he left, he says, "Don't blame yourselves because you did everything for me." Do you believe that now?
Hmm.
I mean, my sense is that he was loved and he had people to love.
So my takeaway from that, and I just so you know, I've only read the note once. I haven't been able to go back to it. I think Daniel had clarity in his last hours, and I truly think there was a point where he felt that I think that the whole point about mental illness is it's so mysterious, and hence Daniel was so shamed more by the fact that he couldn't be honest. He couldn't come open up and say, "I am not well. I don't know what's going on with me, but I hate life." And because when we saw him for the most part, particularly 2008, 2009, he was on a mission to get his summer business going again. It had done well the first couple of years. He was on this trajectory to get to the summer of 2009. So whenever he came home from school, in quotation marks, he wanted to make dinners or he wanted to go, you know, he always was on this, we were always moving forward. So that last few hours, I think he had the clarity to say, whatever skills you had, you know, whatever you tried to do, thank you. You know, but none of us knew, and certainly Daniel didn't realize how this, what started off as a kind of off again, on again, kind of sadness, malaise, would eventually, you know, take him over. And I don't believe that morning he went up that he felt necessarily that you know, that was going to happen. I can't see that yet, but, you know, I've gone away from your question, but I think he was saying, you know, thank you for what you did. And I think it's, you know, in advance of, before he really suffered. And that's the way I think. And also he realized that we didn't have any ability to really save him. And I think he was saying that, you know, and that's also the crime, because that, you know, that we should have had more tools. I should have, that I didn't understand is what haunts me and haunts my husband and my daughters, is that we had no awareness. And now there is awareness. So, you know, we can't prevent every suicide, but we certainly can try to have better outcomes, create better environments for young people to be able to come forward and say, "This is not good. You know, I have dropped out. I have no money. I need help." And then with knowledge, we can then bring that compassion, you know, and save lives. So, you know, there is a, that's, you know, the end result. I feel that my speaking out, my writing about it can only impact the conversation in a positive way.
Yeah, how would you like the conversation to continue? I mean, in reading the book and in talking to you now, I see how woefully we're lacking in terms of the language to deal mm-hmm. with mental illness and depression, suicide in our culture and in our society. How would you like our society to talk about suicide, to talk about mental illness?
I think if we, as a community, organizations who are out there doing great work right now, I think where it really has to begin is like at the elementary level in terms of just understanding mental wellness. I think that is a conversation much like other, we talk about cancer, we talk about heart disease, you know, we have so much information, we celebrate, you know, events that are in support, that raise money, raise awareness. And that's really what mental illness needs. It needs us to speak in a collective voice. All this good work that's out there, and I believe that's what's happening. There's it's almost like a shift. And I think the language that we attach to someone that is as an example, someone said to me the other day, we shouldn't say they're suffering. They're living with a disease. And so I'm sort of trying to strike the word suffering at, but I'm still, you know, sort of fall back to it. But mm-hmm. if we accept also, you know, then moving as the kids get older, if we accept that someone who isn't managing, who isn't coping, and we can have an understanding of that and try to, you know, make treatment available or try to intervene at an earlier age. But also just, I think it's bringing up, it's the language we have to change, the whether it's from the media's reporting of mental illness, suicide, anxiety disorders. We all have to, and I'm every day I'm learning on ways to speak so that someone who is dealing with depression disorder of the brain says, yeah, that I feel like that's me. You know, I want to say something. That, I think, that's how we'll move forward. And it's going to take, you know, it's going to take a lot longer to start to change, you know, or turn the corner on the incredible rates of suicide that we're seeing, particularly in young males. It's second leading cause of death in males, 19 to 24.
Uh-huh.
Something 18 to 24, that's got to change.
Yeah.
So I think we just have to, you know, just all be very aware. And, you know, we weren't. And that, to me, will always be the tragedy that we weren't able to support Daniel.
I finished the book about a day or so ago, and I hate to say that I enjoyed the book, because one doesn't enjoy it so much. I mean, one does appreciate good writing, and you have that in this book, so congratulations on that. But people really ought to read it, because you do such a great job at getting the reader to know Daniel, and he seems like a cool guy. And you do such a service in terms of the conversation that we ought to have in this country. Thanks for this, Lynn.
Thank you, Joe.
The website for more, lynnkeen.ca. The book is called Give Sorrow Words. Starburst Digital is its publisher. Its author, Lynn Keen, joined me on the line from Oakville in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.